cannot dissident discourse. It can only be millennial. And now here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Oh, I was muted. Sorry, everyone. Okay, damn. My apologies. Okay, this is the final stream for tonight, and I'm now here with Isaac Young. This is his first time on Millennial. So, Isaac, welcome to the show, and thank you for agreeing to appear.
Thank you for having me on.
Okay, and would you like to introduce yourself briefly to the audience?
Hi, my name is Isaac Young. I'm a Substack essayist. I write a lot of essays on cultural commentary and fiction. I also have a moderate presence on Twitter. I'm also a sci-fi and fantasy author. I have one book published on Amazon and I'm hoping to have a few new releases by early 2025.
Okay, and you are both fiction and reference, right? Well, I don't know what the term is for that, but a commentary writer, but also a fiction writer, an author. So, and we're going to be talking about fiction and the perilous, well, the dire state that it's in and it has been in for quite some time now, and then ways to resolve that. So I think this should be a very interesting stream. And I think we'll be talking about things that appeal to me. So I might have, I'll try not to interject too much. But all right, so let's go for it then, Isaac. The first stage is to talk about woke storytelling. Let's talk about that first, woke storytelling. How would you characterize that and when did it start roughly? Where did it come from?
Well, I mean, I think woke storytelling's that's the discussion that's already done to death. Personally, it came upon my radar with The Last Jedi and I believe 2018, earlier for a few other people. But I think the culture broadly finally snapped awake when it realized that their stories weren't exactly the same sort of stories that they were used to anymore. They were quite narcissistic. They pandered to certain groups. They were often incompetently done. They favored identity groups above all else, and they didn't care for, you know, original IPs. We have all these reboots of Star Trek, Star Wars, and Indiana Jones, and the modern authors didn't care one bit for the integrity of those IPs or what those IPs stood for. They used them for their own political agendas. And so that'd be a fair characterization of woke storytelling is.
Yeah, that's a very good summary. It's something that people were complaining about maybe, I think from about 2013 onwards, I think people started noticing this. And definitely by the time of The Force Awakens, which I think was 2015, maybe 2016, it was a definite thing. It was a phenomenon. And, I mean, different people would pinpoint different things as the when they first noticed it or the peak of it. But it does seem to be waning at this point, or at least people are exhausted with it at this point. Would you say that there's been a huge imperative to voice certain political ideas? But I mean, I'm guessing you would, but obviously that's not quite the limit of it. It's not just that it's political, it's that the storytelling is simply bad.
Yeah, and I would say it's because they're putting their political ideology above every other consideration in the plot. We can take Star Wars, for example. You know, what is Rey supposed to be except female empowerment? And that obviously gets in the way of any character arc, any interesting commentary. Literally everything in the plot serves to uplift Rey as this feminist icon. And you can see that with tons of other movies. And even if, you know, you're engaging with an older IP, you have older characters who are turned into skin suits of themselves for the sake of the ideology. I think this is like everyone's talked about this to death. I think the interesting thing, this era that we're going to go into for the next 4 years, I said it in our notes. I wanted to talk about post-woke storytelling.
Yes, I wanted to define woke storytelling first before we go to that, because it's an interesting distinction. I mean, what is post-woke? What do you mean by that?
So I don't think that the woke is going to be put away, at least not for mainstream Hollywood. But I feel like for the first time that we have authors in indies, and maybe also a little bit of mainstream presence, who are finally getting around to building up their own platforms enough to basically go into the public sphere. I think there's people are just so exhausted these days that they're also more willing than ever to look for stories that are beyond the woke. And I feel like there's going to be, especially with I hate using the word vibe shift, but vibe shift of the 2024 election, I think there's going to be a huge upswelling of energy for stories that don't adhere to the left's narratives. And I think that there's going to be a great deal of confusion on what a post-woke story even looks like. I think that people are going to be, we all have our own ideas of what the distant right or the far right or reactionary circles ought to be. And I think that that same confusion is going to go into fiction. And everyone's going to have their own idea of what fiction and storytelling ought to look like going forward.
Because this is something that has been enforced very rigorously. So to let go of it is going to be, it's going to be a very strange thing. I don't know. It might be that, well, you're saying that you think within the mainstream media, it won't be put away.
Not entirely. Not to. I mean, they're still going to be releasing Marvel movies. They're still going to be releasing absolute slop. I just think that there's going to be cracks in that establishment that there just simply weren't before. Especially with again the 2024 election, I feel like there's just new energy in this space that is trying to break through. And I don't know specifically what shape that will look like. I have a few good ideas. I have a few strategies on what might be more effective than other things. But its individual presence is going to be largely determined who can mass market most effectively.
And the one substitute for woke storytelling that could be slipped in because it's sort of tried and tested is the 80s and 90s civic nationalism. But that would be, do you think that could just be slipped in? Do you think that they could just sort of revert to that, or do you think that's not possible now?
I don't want to say anything is not possible. I think anything is possible, especially given, Donald Trump narrowly being avoided being assassinated. The problem is with what I see as post-woke storytelling is that the distant right needs to figure out who they're telling stories to. I feel like that's an underrated part of this conversation here. I think that, you know, a lot of the institutions and identities that we used to take for granted, at least over here in America, it might be something different over in Europe, but at least here in America, there's no collective identity anymore. At least none that I can really detect. It feels like, you know, the country is set divided against each other and we're all just warring groups, each with our own side. And, if we're going to try to get into this realm of, okay, we want high art, we want good stories again, who are these stories being told for? How are we going to write these stories, and what are the symbols and symbols, myths, religion, ethnicity, all those elements. How is that going to factor into new stories that we're going to tell going forward?
And do you think that, I see that that is an interesting point that you make there, that when people in the dissident right try to embark on this kind of thing, they have to question, well, who is this for? Who am I aiming towards? Because the the receivers of woke storytelling and woke fiction and so on are obviously not going to be amenable to something rooted in hierarchy, tradition, Catholicism, or anything Eurocentric. That is what they're committed against, as what they have been trained to oppose. But then there is the other argument, which is that those people are actually primed for our kind of thing because they recognize groups and the importance of groups, whereas the centrist civic nationalist type is blind to all of that. And so the kind of stories that we might want to tell would mean nothing to that person.
I would say that the left particularly is just exhausted at this stage. I don't think that in terms of if we tell good stories or if someone out there can tell a good story, I think more than not, they'll indulge in it with like a sort of guilty pleasure type sense, because there's no good entertainment. No one likes woke Star Wars, not even the left do. For example, on Twitter, I see people post stuff about what they love about the prequels all the time. You know, it's some armor design, it's some battle scene, some character moment. The left don't do this for the sequels. Unless for some reason the algorithm boosts it, but they don't talk about it outside of like small conversations. They don't praise it. They just consume the next thing.
Well, the only thing that you can really say for the new Star Wars films is that they fulfill a political criteria. Other than that, they're charmless.
Yeah.
They're dreadful.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I would say in terms of trying to get back to good storytelling, and this is another thing in the notes, I think that a lot of people, I noticed discussions a few months ago about Game of Thrones, and I think a lot of people secretly want to get back to that era of Game of Thrones television, even on the right.
Well, that's an interesting, because I think Game of Thrones is for the millennial generation. And this is something where you can really, I think the generations are very, it's very relevant here. For the millennials, Game of Thrones is their TV show. It's the thing that sort of inaugurated their arrival into, you know, mid-20s, late-20s. And, it sort of defined them in a way. And so I think it remains important to them for that reason. It's tied to a moment in time for them. But as for the program itself, I should say that I never watched it. I've never seen a single episode of Game of Thrones. It's just not my kind of thing. I just knew it wouldn't appeal to me. So I want you to speak about it and reference it and so on, but unfortunately I won't get the references.
Oh, don't worry. I'm not going to reference it too much. In terms of, actually, I think it's quite funny, my own history with that TV show. So I was of age to watch something like Game of Thrones right around season 6 dropped. Up until that point, I only read the books. So I actually never got to watch the good, air quote, seasons of Game of Thrones. I only watched the bad ones, season 6 through 8, which I find hilarious. But Game of Thrones is the epitome of a trend I see, and I think a proper distinction ought to be made. So I want to make a distinction between competent storytelling and good storytelling. I think Game of Thrones falls quite clearly into the realm of competent storytelling. Meanwhile, let's say something like Lord of the Rings would fall into the realm of what we would say good storytelling, something that's uplifting to the soul at the very least, or elevates the mind to higher things. I suppose in order to try to get this distinction, very well. So if you were to ask a person what makes a well thought out story, a decent story in their mind, what would they say to you? If you ask the average person, you know, what would you want to see more of?
A good storyline.
I would say, I've talked to a lot of people and I would say that definitely falls into it, but like they would give you an answer, something along the lines of deep characters, a plot that asks difficult questions, morally complex, a conflict where you can see both sides, where realistic, able to talk about things that need to be talked about, stuff like that. Would you agree?
Yes, that would be the more politically aware. That'd be like the women's studies graduate would answer with that.
And I notice in all these discussions, you know, when we talk about, you know, what makes a good TV show, they don't discuss their beliefs that much. They don't discuss their religion or how they draw from tradition. They don't talk about their culture or their heritage or their history or influences that stretch back more than, you know, influences of IPs that are more than 20 years old. You know, and if we were to take a look at, you know, some of the greats, like Tolkien, for example, he could have given you very good answers on those points where I don't think average people would be able to give you good answers. Tolkien would say, I'm writing a mythos for the British people. I am a devout Catholic. I am drawing from the folklore and myths. I am well-versed in these high texts, which I can reference and draw from to add commentary. And I have something that I believe that I am striving towards. And that would be a answer that I feel like separates good storytelling from competent storytelling. Competent storytelling asks those abstract earlier questions, where good storytelling is a much more so a dialogue about belief.
I think good storytelling, I mean, competent storytelling is like the difference between a well-crafted late 80s Kylie Minogue pop song, which is just structurally perfect. It hits the spot. It does the job. It's exciting. It's very well produced and all that. And something that's actually meaningful. A song that's actually... And the thing is, it takes a lot of effort to make that Kylie Minogue pop song.
I'll let you finish, sorry.
I think it was Pete Waterman. He said, because he was that trio of producers, and he said, it actually takes a lot of skill to make something that 10 million people will like. It's much easier to make something that only 10 people will like. And, you know, that's probably true. That's not the end of the matter, though, because you can spend a lot of effort and time and talent making something that 10 million people will like, but that doesn't mean it's good. And I think a question is, I would say a good story is one that's good for people, that's health, that's nourishing for them. And this is where I think Game of Thrones, from what I've heard about it, completely fails, because it's just nihilistic. And you can see this when you look at George R. R. Martin, that he's just not a very pleasant guy. Versus Tolkien, who had a much harder life and fought in the war and so on, and yet came out with something that is good for people, something that does nourish them. Now, George R. R. Martin, I'm sure he's a very competent storyteller. He must be to be as popular as he is. But I don't think that what he does is good for people.
Yeah, I mean, the distinction comes down to prose versus the substance of the prose. You know, I'm not disputing the skill it takes into writing something like A Song of Ice and Fire. By no means is someone who is very, very adept at their craft. But ultimately, A Song of Ice and Fire isn't going to last, because it couldn't provide the substance that it needed to. I think it's already lost most of its cultural power, and within the next few decades, it will be mostly forgotten.
Oh, I agree. I definitely think that that is, that moment is over. People will continue to reference the memes, but, you know, so what? I use memes that I, of films and stuff that I've never seen, including Game of Thrones, actually. So I think it will continue to linger, but I don't think, and I think for a certain, you know, as I said, the millennials, I think it will always be that, it will be tied to a moment in their lives that they remember fondly when they were young. But yeah, I think the enthusiasm for it has, is definitely all right. I mean, if they announced now a spin-off to it.
Oh, they already did.
Well, I know the House of the Dragon thing, but it's got its own life, really, because it seems to be quite good, actually. But let's say George R.R. Martin, I know he's failing to write, to complete the series of books, but does anyone care at this point? I mean, it's over in that sense.
Yeah, every single time, like every single time I George R. R. Martin post, I get that one person in the replies who says, "But he didn't finish the books yet." And I'm just like, I'm talking about the ending I have in front of me. the ending I have. I can't talk about what doesn't exist.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I know that a lot of people don't like the. See, this is funny. I've never seen a single episode, but I know quite a lot about it just by osmosis. And probably a lot of people are like this, where they know that the last season is dreadful. A lot of people really don't like it. They especially don't like the final episode. They think the wrong person won, and it was kind of meaningless, didn't make much sense. It was incoherent. This is the stuff that I've gleaned without ever watching any of it.
Yeah, the season 8 is it dips from sort of sensical to just absolute chaos of the story. Like there's no coherent meaning you could get out of a season 8 ending. Yeah.
Well, so to get back on track then, I think that the point that we were you were making was that it's not going to last. It's not going to endure. It has already peaked, 10 years ago, a long time ago now. So, yeah, I agree. Whereas Lord of the Rings will endure even despite things like the Rings of Power.
Yeah, and this sort of gets into, I guess, our next talking point. I think storytelling requires in terms of if we're going to get into what the substance actually means, one essential component of storytelling that I feel doesn't really get discussed in terms of why so much fiction sucks nowadays is symbols and the subtextual commentary. So I'll give an example off the top of my head, so we can talk about Tolkien's elves, right? And they command a certain magic whenever you see them on screen or you're reading them in the books, and that's because they're drawing from a transcendental tradition that gets at something eternal, something true. My own personal interpretation is getting at an image of pre-fallen man. There's a bit more to that. Don't get mad at me, Tolkien nerds, but they're getting at something that is that fundamentally speaks to the human spirit. And that symbol, the elf, it's lost that meaning. You notice this with a lot of authors who cribbed off Tolkien. They used elves, they used dwarves, they used orcs, but none of those things commanded quite that same magic. And I would say this is the case because authors understood very well the superficial elements of Lord of the Rings, but they didn't understand the deeper components, the wellspring from which those symbols drew from. And so we get to now in our modern culture where elves are people with pointy ears who are very pretentious and they live long. Dwarves are short people with Scottish accents and they live in mountains. Orcs are apparently an oppressed minority that need to be protected. at least according to the Rings of Power. I didn't see that coming. Well, actually, I did see that coming, but I didn't think they would actually go through with it, but they did. But these things, when they're removed from substance, and I know orcs are a Tolkien invention. They don't really have a basis in folklore, but I would say that Tolkien does a very good job with them anyway, much more so than any other author. Like when these things are removed from their substance, they just become very hollow. I'll do one Game of Thrones reference, the Children of the Forest, which are George R. R. Martin's equivalent of elves, and they're not even discussed. I've never seen anyone discuss them in the past, at least ever since season 8 premiered, not once. Meanwhile, you still have people talking about Beren and Luthien.
Yeah, I've never heard of this. The Children of whatever that was.
Yeah, the Children of the Forest. They're George R. R. Martin's equivalent of elves. They have all the superficial characteristics twisted a little bit, but they're essentially the same thing as Tolkien wrote, except that. At least, again, superficially, but they completely lacked that substance, and they lacked the staying power as well.
Because this is his materialistic universe.
Yes.
I mean, there can't be anything... Well, you describe that for people.
Well, I mean, he doesn't ground it in anything. There's no symbology behind it. There's no subtext. There's no really commentary. They're just a different group of people who turns out to be a bit racist towards humans, and that's how the White Walkers were created, apparently. But you know, with let's bring it back to Tolkien. Like you have he drew from fairies, and you have an entire tradition right there of stories involving these creatures, what they might be, their relationship with mankind, that is far stronger and rooted in something that the Children of the Forest never were. And so no one ever talks about the Children of the Forest.
It's horrible. You see, the thing is, that same mindset, if the elves are not important, well, the Children of the Forest, it translates over to this Rings of Power, where the orcs cannot be condemned, so they cannot be inferior. There has to be some reason why they are the way they are. I mean, you know, socioeconomic factors kind of thing. It can't be inherent to them, that they must be, because this is the progressive dream that everyone can be elevated. Everyone is equal, really, and it's just trivial factors that are getting in the way of that. I mean, it's a really, again, it's a sort of impoverished view of reality, because it disallows so much. In the same thing with, you know, good and evil. If you insist on everything being shades of grey and morally dubious and so on, then you're impoverishing life, I think.
I mean, if good and evil are nothing more than economic factors, then you've reduced the most transcendental conflict of all of human history to a economic equation on the whiteboard. That's not something you can create a compelling story out of. It's not true. Also, I would say that it's more importantly, it's not true.
Definitely.
And it's nothing that is going to fix anything. It's nothing going to elevate anyone's soul. No one wants to hear about how we need to redistribute, you know, another $10 million to Africa or whatever to fix human sin. That's all we need, is just to rebalance our checking book for the federal government's budget. And after that, we're going to be in the utopia. No one cares about that. No one wants to hear that.
No, and this is actually why the Lord of the Rings memes are so funny, because it's such a distortion of the actual story. when you must have seen these memes. I'll try to get one up on screen for you, but it's hold on a second. Yeah, this kind of thing is hilarious. Not there we go.
that's good. That's quite good.
I've got so many of them. And again, I haven't actually seen the films or read the books, I'm afraid. And that is something that I do regret. I want to read Lord of the Rings. It's just a matter of not being so busy all the time. But anyway, I've intervened too much here. I think you were on the point of... all right, so elves have lost all their transcendental symbolism and just become people with pointy ears. It's a weird thing. I think that atheism lends itself, it sort of points towards this sort of thing, where if we're not going to be religious, then it's kind of silly to believe in fantasy. And it's kind of silly. We're letting ourselves down. We're being indulgent. The responsible thing is not to have fantasy storytelling and not really to believe in it. It's certainly not to let it be transcendental, because we don't believe in transcendence. So you end up with, Game of Thrones, you end up with this very materialistic world building and storytelling.
Well, I mean, if the atheists truly believed that fantasy was useless, then they wouldn't write fantasy at all. But you have a lot of people who are on the hard left who do write fantasy. And I think that's indicative of an appetite for transcendental substance that they try to fill in their works, but ultimately fail because they don't have the grounding to do so.
Indeed. And this is the thing, because I think what you see with Game of Thrones and that this era now is... this generation of writers, people in their 40s, 30s, 20s, who it's like for the first time, it's people who didn't grow up in a Christian community. They might have had a Christian family, but it wasn't omnipresent. And so, and in a lot of cases, it would be quite staunchly atheist. So this is, I think, the drama that such people produce. It seems to me that it's just a huge problem. And you end up with this stuff.
I was told, on Twitter, and this was someone who was speaking sincerely, that, all the good stories have already been told, that, every single possible narrative has pretty much already been exhausted. The only new fiction that we can really create are remixes that yield diminishing returns every single time. And eventually everything is just going to be exhausted retellings. And he didn't say this part, but it would be necessary from his worldview that he was espousing, that the only way for fiction to really feel fresh again is if mankind forgot all these stories somehow, I guess, in some apocalypse or some catastrophe that just erases all memory, and then we can begin anew again.
What do you think about that? I mean, I have an opinion, but what do you think?
Well, I think materialist and modern fiction is dead. But the problem is that all these people are drawing their inspirations from derivatives of pop culture works. Who are the writers of Alien Romulus drawing from, the latest Alien movie? What are their great works that they're drawing from? They're drawing from the last Alien movie, if that, unless they want to be, making up their own woke messaging. They're not drawing from anything that's eternal, something that lasts. And those things that are eternal, I find that they have a way of renewing themselves from each generation to each generation. And the problem is that most writers have cut themselves off utterly from those sources. I mean, you look at any other period in history, right? New stories still found a way of being told that were completely new. And it's, you know, we're not at the end of history where everything is, you know, just stopped.
It is. It's fascinating, isn't it? What you say about Romulus there is very interesting, because I haven't seen it. I do want to see it. I will see it, but not yet. And what I've heard about it is that it's heavily clumsily referential of the other films, the previous films. And it does seem to be, I mean, it does seem to expand the lore, but it is drawing solely from the lore. So there's nothing else underpinning it. It's like a copy of a copy. It's fiction referencing fiction. It's not coming from real life. Whereas I'm pretty damn sure that the first Alien film, to some extent, was derived from real life. Which is probably why the characters are so good, and the acting is so good, the story rings true, the dynamics ring true. It's just an overall good story, but again, I'm not saying that Romulus is anything. I haven't seen it, so I'm not going to comment on that. But I think you have this. Again, it's a generation who haven't really lived. They haven't really lived life. They go to university and then they go into the media that's how it seems to me, like they're drawing on nothing. But then another point of problem here, and it goes back to the wokery, is that any experiences that they have had in real life have to be filtered through that lens, that political lens. So there is only one conclusion that can be drawn from each thing, and it's the one preordained by the ideology. So therefore they can't show something it's ironic. They can't actually show something from both sides or all sides, even though that they pretend to. But what they mean is they'll show one character's selfish desires conflicting with another character's selfish desires, but they're not actually showing the different intellectual interpretations or moral interpretations of what's going on. They're just showing two selfish people in conflict with each other, but so what? They're not actually... They're always limited by the need to conform to woke politics. Otherwise, they're a bad person, and they simply wouldn't... I mean, it simply wouldn't be allowed. You couldn't write a story in which... mass immigration is a bad thing. You couldn't write a story in which diversity is harmful or a weakness. You couldn't write a story in which a woman wants to be dominated by a man. I guess they did it with 50 Shades of Grey, but that was sort of cartoonish.
That's smut. That falls into a separate category. When it comes to making pornography, the left will throw out feminism They will satisfy their fetishes and throughout the ideology when they just want to appease appetites.
Yeah, and you know my point is that they again with race, they could never say that they could never have a story where actually some groups of people need to, the best thing for them is to be led stewarded by another group of people. Because they're just whatever, they're not up to it for whatever reason. That would be an absolutely unthinkable story to write in today's climate. But even the more subtle stuff, like a woman who really just doesn't want a career, she wants to be a mother. So you're whatever the situation is, there is a preordained conclusion that must be drawn from it, and a preordained direction that it must go in. And I really think this is part of why a lot of storytelling now is just so flat and lifeless, because it's all preordained. It cannot honestly reflect. It cannot innocently contemplate. It has to indoctrinate.
I'd say there's also another aspect to this in just the way we tell stories nowadays, or at least the way we have a theory of storytelling that is incredibly formulaic. Like any, if you get into the industry or you talk to people who are in the industry, I mean, they will tell you, you know, we need to make generally fast paced stories that never really do anything out of the, to give an example, Tolkien's Tom Bombadil, for example, that would never make it past a modern editor. That'll get cut. And, you know, a lot of people have complicated thoughts on Tom Bombadil. But, you know, that kind of unexpected whimsy that just appears in the text that's allowed to go where it may, that's also just a part of writing. And if you don't allow for that, then, of course, all your stories are going to be the same. And there's another moment that people quite like. There's a moment where the hobbits, Merry, Pippin, Frodo, and Samwise Gamgee are sleeping under a tree, and a fox treads by. And the fox basically thinks to himself, oh, hobbits sleeping outside? What strange times are these? There's something afoot going on. And then Tolkien says, oh, he was quite right about it, but he never found out anything else about it. And it's quite a funny moment. But like, if you were to throw that into a modern editor, they'd be like, oh, well, that, you know, that shifts the perspective. It leaves the reader confused. You know, are all foxes intelligent in this world now? Do they all have thoughts? How does this impact the plot? Are all animals supposed to have this, you know, intelligence? And they would say more likely than not, just cut it. And then you lose that moment, which is, you know, I wouldn't say it's like, you know, transcendental or anything, but it's just this little whimsical moment that's just lost. And if that's all you're doing is just sanding down the story to remove all those moments, of course, you're going to end up with mass produced stuff that all feels the same when you read it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's getting rid of the eccentricities that characterize it as the work of a person. Again, sorry to quote 1984, but in that O'Brien says, no book is individually produced. It's all by committee. Because the voice of an individual is potentially very dangerous.
Yeah, I would say it's unpredictable. And if I'd speak from personal experience here, the voice of the individual is not just something that's really, we think of writing as you know, some great master laying down the buildings of a great, you know, monument, and everything is carefully selected. You know, it's all pre-planned. It's all this, you know, you have this gigantic outline of all the details and everything, but no, a lot of writing is jumping right in and seeing what surprises you as you go along. And I think a good writer always leaves that door open to where even the story itself can surprise them, where it takes on its own life. And I think those are the best sorts of stories.
Yeah. Yeah.
To be honest.
All right. So moving on to no folk to generate high culture. And you said culture implies a shared ground of understanding. Why don't you talk about that? And how does that relate to our modern day?
So I kind of covered this a bit earlier, and I'll change up examples to try and attack this from a new angle. But I mean, a folk is shared by a people who share a common identity, and that identity is filtered through a lot of things, just historical experiences, technology, history, religion, ethnicity, and like just hundreds of other things that just bind a people together. And the problem with storytelling these days that's downstream of our culture is that we're all very atomized, and we're just individual. And so when a person is trying to grasp at this shared experience to get to communicate with the audience, those things often fall flat on their face. To use a more common example that people probably be familiar with is The Simpsons. where the show had this understanding where, you know, the average suburban dad had a house. And, you know, his wife was, you know, the real brains of the operation. But she was, you know, she was sort of depressed and, you know, could live up to her potential. But she settles for this guy. And then they have, you know, three children, whatever, and a dog and a cat and a stable job. But a problem with the West is, you know, well, a lot of kids grew up in divorced households. They didn't have anything really stable. Those even those fundamental units of identity, which previous authors could take for granted to communicate experience with, you know, here's a dad joke moment. A lot of people don't have that anymore. And so that's another barrier, which I think people don't really talk about much, is all our experiences are slowly being whittled away to being completely individual. And contrary to what the left and modern society wants you to believe, where they think that if we can create everything for the sake of the individual, by the individual, if you can just be allowed to express your true self, unmoored by any of those social norms, then that's true art. But if you do that, you can't really communicate anything because people just don't understand where you're coming from. Modern Gen Zers, I think by and large, can't really relate to The Simpsons or even understand what it's trying to say on a deep level, because it's that the world's gone.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Homer works at a plant and he supports a wife and three kids. You know, that, I don't know, is that possible in America now? Is that, does anyone have that life now?
It's still very possible. It's just, there's just huge hurdles that that just didn't exist for that show in that time period.
Hmm. I think that's amazing that Zoomers can't even understand it.
I would say understand's probably a really big, like, that's a big word. Like in terms of, yeah, identify with it. Like they could probably get, like, they could definitely get, like, superficially everything. But if I'm going to talk, it's like a very visceral experience. So there are these moments in The Simpsons that are really, truly great and special. Like where Homer actually stands up and becomes a good dad for like 90 seconds of the show. And if you were to show that to a Gen Zer whose parents were divorced and all of that, like just the concept of parenthood itself is alien, that's not going to come across as particularly heartwarming. That just opens up a void in their heart. And so that's not, the audience is like the artist is trying to communicate something very heartfelt, something very, you know, very deep, personal, and what they think is uplifting. Meanwhile, to, you know, that, so that particular Gen Zer, that's just a smack in the face and they just don't understand it.
Right. And of course the writer would hope that it was also pretty much universal. Everyone has had a dad. Everyone's seen that moment where their dad came through for them, where he was the hero of the day. And so, yeah, it's an innocent thing. But for someone who doesn't have a dad or who had, you know, their parents were split up, it's something, alien and alienating. I understand that. But I think, I mean, if you're going to therefore eliminate such moments from a show, well, eventually, is there going to be anyone who can identify? I mean,
I'm not arguing in terms of like eliminating those moments by no means. I'm just saying that there is unexpected barriers that prop up that appear when we individualize everything to the point where there's no shared experience to communicate those sorts of things. Like there's,
yeah, what I mean is, if you were to do that, eventually what experiences can be communicated? Because obviously everyone does have different circumstances.
They do. I think that the common things that we have in common, the common things that we share allow us to communicate a lot better and allow us to get our intended meaning across. And yeah. I think that when we individualize things to the point where we don't share those things in common, that breaks down the ability for artists to communicate their intended meaning to an audience.
Yeah, I can see that diversity requirements would make it pretty, make it very difficult because of all exactly this kind of thing. It would make it very difficult for a writer to write something that resonated, if we might use that fashionable word, with himself or anyone else. Because, well, I can't write about my dad. I can't write about dad's fatherhood, being the child of a father, to name just one example. But you're obviously, it boxes you in to such an extent that, as I say, I think you'd be struggling to write anything. It's very paralyzing. And I don't know, in the end, what does everyone share? What could you write? The main character went to McDonald's because everyone can go to McDonald's. that's awful.
The leftist tendency is to create a story that writes for everyone. I think that the far right, distant right, whatever, has to write stories for particular groups. And that's part of what I think post-woke fiction needs to do, is it needs to have very clear ideas about who they are writing for what purpose. And that earlier discussion about being able to communicate with shared experiences, I think that needs to go into creating works of art, is those just understanding the group's shared identity and being able to write for a specific population.
So it's very I don't know if localized would be quite the right word, but specific.
Yes, particular.
Yeah, particular. Yeah. I agree. I think that this is, see, part of the problem is, and I remember somebody once pointing this out to me, that white people aren't allowed to find anything exotic anymore, because that, to find something exotic is to be exclusionary. You're saying that thing is not part of my normal life. That thing is a rarity. It's a novelty. It's weird and interesting to me. So, for example, you can't have, Diwali, the festival of Diwali. That cannot be an exotic novelty anymore. You have to present it as white people. It's part of their lives. They know it very well. It's not foreign to them. It's quite uninteresting to them. Well, I mean, that deadens everything. But it also nullifies, you can't have a perspective. And I think this is really what a lot of this has been pointing towards, is that you're just not allowed to have a a white perspective in any way, in any fiction. So everything has to include everyone else, and it certainly can't be, it can't alienate them.
Yeah, and they also, they do the 1-2 double tap, where you can't view anything as exotic, but you also can't view anything as your own either. So even if you wanted to adopt that exotic to try to make a new identity, you would immediately be called as appropriating their culture, and you'd be denounced for it. It goes both ways, where they stop you from ever really. Both in terms of viewing something as other and viewing something as inside.
Yeah, it's like that diagram. I do have it, but I won't be able to find it. It would take ages to find it. But it's that diagram about basically how whatever white people do, it's wrong. If you gentrify, then you're gentrifying. If you don't, then you're leaving them. It's white flight. If you notice race, then you're racist. If you don't notice race, then you're racist. It's a similar thing here with storytelling. But I'm looking through my meme folder, and I can't see it, so it would take ages. So you just have to take my word for it. But so, yeah, it cuts off all these avenues for possible storytelling. and leaves you with something very generic. I think that's a word we probably should have used before now in this conversation. And the generic is inherently dull. It's funny because, you know, in the 80s and 90s, I would see films from America, a bunch of American kids, you know, going out on some adventure. I wasn't an American kid. I wasn't an American kid in the 80s. And indeed, American kids today are not American kids in the 80s. But I could watch that film and identify, not even identify, just enjoy it, like sort of as if I was there with them. And I'm sure, again, American kids today could do the same thing. They could travel that temporal distance to share in the happiness and fear and trepidation and excitement of those kids. So it's not alienating in that, like, it's okay. Whereas today, I think the mantra would be try to make it as relatable as possible. So it has to look like it could be anywhere. And the kids should certainly look like they're from everywhere. So there's no specificity.
And they end up looking like they're from nowhere as a result.
Yeah. But it's just, I don't know, it's just horrible. But to return to, because obviously we didn't want this to just be a lament. You said that we have to think about the audience, think about, and of course that would imply marketing towards a sector of people, so that, I mean, I hope that's possible. I think it's definitely becoming possible. I don't know if you heard the chat the other night with Dave Martell, but he's very optimistic about this kind of thing. So you would obviously want to limit it, because by limiting it, you enable yourself to have a focus and have a community that you're shaping this thing for. And then you can inject commonality, common things into that story.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. I think you need to be writing for a particular time, place, and people. And that is the only way in which you're going to reach something that actually endures. Because, you know, everyone across the world enjoys Lord of the Rings, I think in large part because it was written for a particular people, and it wasn't written for the world. It was written for Britain.
Yeah, that's the ironic thing about it. But I agree. I think you're absolutely right. And then the final stage here is rebuilding fiction. And you say simple truths are paramount. That is interesting because it's so in contrast to the mentality of, you know, Game of Thrones, that kind of thing, where it's all about shades of grey and everything's very complex and nuanced. And you're talking about championing the opposite of that.
Well, I was thinking about, all right, so, you know, there's a lot of specific things that have just been broken down. I feel that a good way, and I've seen this exemplified in several TV shows and stories over the years, is that what the right ought to do is simply repeat basic truths. That's the entire right's meme philosophy, isn't it? The right can meme because it can just say something plainly if it's short. Meanwhile, the left have to create an entire essay of a meme in order to get their viewpoint across, because their viewpoint isn't structured in reality. It's just wall after analysis after text after, and it's awful to read. Like it's literally like an essay in of itself. Meanwhile, the right can say, "You're fake and gay." And leave it at that. For like, I guess a recent example of a simple truth that I thought was extraordinarily effective, and it caused a lot of discourse, much more so than I see much more complex media getting, is this anime called Frieren. And Frieren doesn't really do anything particularly new or innovative. It is itself in many ways derivative, but the one thing it does a few things very well, but one thing that really sparked the internet was it presented demons as unambiguously evil. It presented an objective evil that wasn't turned into like, oh, they got to think about their side. Oh, they're secretly sympathetic. Oh, the orcs actually have families. No, the demons in Frieren were objectively evil. And that set off the left like you wouldn't believe. And they still bring it up and cope about it. I think that's a simple truth that the right should embrace, is that objective evil exists. Because the left are all about including things. They're about breaking down boundaries. They're about breaking down taboo. But if you were to say, no, this thing is unambiguously evil, then that will get under their skin like nothing else. At least so far as I've seen.
I hadn't heard of this. It's a manga series, Frieren.
Yep, and also an anime. It got an anime adaptation, I think, about last year.
Right. So the left are simply disturbed by the idea that something could be just simply evil and condemned as such.
Yes. They made like hour long essay videos on this subject, trying to sympathize with the demons. And that's sort of a similar thing, with Starship Troopers.
Starship. Yeah. Yeah. I saw that on Twitter. That was hilarious, where they were identifying with the bugs.
It's the same thing right there, whereas they literally have to identify with the worst possible thing you can depict. And so, literally whatever story, the left will pick the worst possible thing in that story and they will identify with it. It does not matter how ugly it is. It doesn't matter if it's an insect. It doesn't matter if it's an abomination. It doesn't matter if it's like a Lovecraftian monstrosity from beyond the stars. They're going to identify with Cthulhu if that's the worst thing in your story.
I don't know. I just don't know what to say. I mean, they're so lost. And I understand the thinking that, well, everyone's got a story, everyone's got a background, everyone's got reasons and motivations and, you know, socioeconomic factors are there, yes. But that doesn't, first of all, that doesn't mean you can't condemn someone. And second, it's not actually narratively helpful. Sometimes it's narratively useful, and that means psychologically useful for the reader or viewer, to have something that is just simply evil. I understand that they're saying it's more sophisticated if you do it this way. It's more sophisticated if you think that everything can be understood, and you know that the paedophile, he actually once helped a little old lady with her shopping, so there's some good in him. Yeah, sure, there is. I believe you, but paedophilia is still evil. I mean, you cannot forget that. And this is the thing. It's not like, I don't think anyone is actually saying that someone is wholly, totally, completely, absolutely evil. The point is more that you can't discount that evil is a force in the world, and that people are susceptible to it, and that evil is absolute. Even though it doesn't affect people absolutely, it is an absolute thing.
Well, I mean, it implies there's a threshold where some people ought to be condemned. Just plain and simply, like that pedophile, we need to remove him, and do so in ways that make the left very, very uncomfortable. They don't believe that anything ought to be condemned. And if I were to, I don't know if this is a bit going too far, but if I were to speculate on the psychological reasoning, because they're afraid of being condemned themselves. And maybe that would be justified in some cases.
Yeah, I think a lot of this is projection.
Yeah.
It's an incomplete or underdeveloped psychology.
If you're identifying with the demons, there's some interesting things going on in your psyche. And maybe more than a few skeletons in the closet that ought to be brought out to light. But that's just me.
Mm, mm. Well, is there anything else that you would like to say about, because I think your last line there is interesting, and you end it with, we should begin with speaking plainly and building from there. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I think in terms of what the right wants to do, and I think what we should be doing is rebuilding those commonalities between groups, rebuilding social norms. I think that's what we all want, is something that's stable, that's constant, that we can rely on, that's not going to be subverted in the next 5 to 10 to 15 to 20 years, that's not going to be upstaged by the revolution. We want a firm foundation. And from that firm foundation, that's the only way we're ever going to be able to build anything, including stories. And I think that firm foundation just begins with simple truths, that, you know, we can plainly see, not that there are some groups that out there who are going to contest those things, but those things which they're things that we believe are true, that are true, such as, let's say, the distinction between men and women. And I think those are starting places for hashing out, okay, if you disagree with this, if you think men can become women and vice versa, and that we ought to give pubescent blockers to children, then if you believe those things, you just ought to be excluded from the group, and you ought to be condemned, and you ought to be removed in whatever form that takes place. And the sorts of simple things that we can build off from there. And those things will eventually evolve into, as they get more complex, they evolve into traditions, rituals. As we develop morals out from there, we develop rituals and, you know, basically culture again. And I don't think we have to do this. We don't have to do this from scratch, thank goodness. We have those things already there in European identities, American identities, and religion. And we all the major work in that regard is sort of already done for us. We just have to take it back up again.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think what you say is very important, that simple truths, I think people can be sort of bored with simple truths or unpersuaded or unimpressed by them, because they expect, we've been trained to expect grandiosity and sophistication, complexity. But actually a lot of life is very, there are a lot of simple truths. And in this day and age, we've been blinded to a lot of them.
I think I think the notion that simple truths are boring, in practice, I see simple truths dropping as bombshells on people, really, because everyone's so trained to think in the most complex, sophisticated way that they're just, when something strikes them, like Freeran did, it comes completely by surprise. It takes takes a good chunk of the internet by storm. It generates attention.
Yeah.
And there was one other part I wanted to discuss in terms of simple truths, one part after that, in terms of taking the internet by storm and generating that mass production that you would need to fight a culture war. But I'll let you finish. Sorry.
Well, I was just going to reinforce your point that I think you're absolutely right. People feign to be bored by simple truths, or, as I say, unimpressed, because they've got a degree in gender studies or something. But in actual fact, as you say, they're bowled over by simple truths. Simple truths are terrifying for the mind that is that has become accustomed to obfuscation and delusion, and is also lost in delusion. A simple truth is like the light in the dark there. And there are, as I say, plenty of simple truths that just demolish so much pretension and delusion. So yeah, I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah, I think that's in terms of, I think that's a really good starting point in terms of what should post woke storytelling be, is finding things that are real, depicting them honestly in your stories, and then letting those stories be the bombshell instead of trying to create this thesis from which, and you see this with a lot of Christian evangelical movies, where they create very dishonest depictions of reality in order to get a dunk on their enemies. Whereas I would argue, actually to give an example, like God's Not Dead, for example, that's basically, that movie is just an essay on the atheist versus theist debates. And at the end, the atheist gets in a car accident because that's how, that's the ultimate dunk. Whereas it's not honest. It feels a bit slimy. And that's the reason why it didn't have a lasting impact on the culture. Like, something like, you know, something as innocuously stupid as we might call it free will. Just because one put forward a very simple truth and was honest about it. And it felt like it was being honest with itself and not trying to, you know, be a push forward a political agenda of any sort.
Yeah. Well, heavy handedness is always a problem, especially when you have a lot of concerns with society and political complaints. It is a temptation to be very heavy and sort of too simplistic and too aggressive, too doctrinaire, and then that leads to just bad storytelling. Then we made the same mistake that our opponents have made.
Yeah, and it's fake. I don't really know how else to put it. If you're more concerned about speaking from the pulpit than you are telling a good story, then just go speak from the pulpit. Stories are very specific things. They ought not to be propaganda. Even though they're drawn from your beliefs, you shouldn't be writing to evangelize first. Just go be a missionary then. The story is supposed to be something that is good in of itself, not what you can do through the story. It's supposed to, art is always good in of itself. It's something that is beautiful on its own merits. It's something that's uplifting on its own merits. And if you're writing for this ends justify the means mindset, you're never going to write a good story.
Yeah, definitely. And that takes us back to what we were saying earlier, that for the last 10 years, that has been the goal of storytelling, and the result has been terrible stories.
Yeah.
Right. Is there anything else that you'd like to say?
I didn't have this particular thought completely. I'm still wrestling with it in many ways, but there's some interesting observations. I've been exploring where fiction is still being produced. You know, like we, like there's a idea that storytelling and books are dead, that video games and movies and television are the new media going forward, and that books are old hat, no one reads them, and you know, if you want to win the culture war, that you ought to stick to those other platforms instead of stories. I don't think that's true. I think that something that has been very, very interesting to me is I've been exploring where people are still writing fiction on these online web forums. And you look at these people, they're making quite a bit of money also. But the way the market seems to be set up nowadays is they're aiming to basically mass produce fiction. it's become this very sterile commodity, which is heavily emphasizing quantity over quality. They're generating about 15 to 20 pages a day. And that struck me as very odd, because I have no idea how you can write 15 to 20 pages a day and not burn out and have it still be good. I think that just the way we consume art nowadays has strangely become very, very consumptive, for lack of a better word. And I don't quite know how we're going to approach that problem, except by trying to create quality over quantity and trying to create something that is better from an artistic perspective than slop. But I don't know how we're going to win that particular battle.
Well, again, that gets to the issue of distribution and fashion making, which is a different conversation, but it's certainly an equally important problem. All right. Well, let's leave it at that. I think this has been a really interesting conversation. I hope I've given you the chance to fully express these ideas. Even though I haven't seen Game of Thrones or read or seen Lord of the Rings.
I know you're a Doctor Who fan. Is that right?
Yeah, but I don't like to talk about it. It's kind of embarrassing.
I was a Doctor Who fan for a long time too. I think there's some very interesting things about that show before it went super gay.
Well, yeah, let's not get into that, because people have heard me talking about Doctor Who enough already. I don't want to bore them with it. But yeah, it's when would you say, just out of interest, when would you say that it went super gay?
I mean, right. All right. So I think Christopher Eccleston, David Tennant were the best eras. It was Matt Smith. It was Doctor Number 11 is where things went off the rails by the end. And then after that, I forget the actor who played Number 12, because I checked out the show by then. But the actor for Number 12 only had a few good moments, and everything else was just slop. And it was kind of like that transitory period where between 11 and 12, where everything was just lost.
Yeah, I can see that argument. I think 12 was Peter Capaldi.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I never liked the new series from 2005 on, so it was never my thing, really.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. Well, I was too old by that time, really, to get into it. But anyway, that's a whole other thing. All right, let's leave it there. I think this has been a good conversation, so thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. I will be back tomorrow. And I think tomorrow is, right, tomorrow is another standard four interviews. The first is with UK Column, then The Woodlander, then Red Ice, and then Jeremy McKenzie. So that should be a good night. I will see you all for that. But in the meantime, Isaac Young, thank you for appearing on Millennial X.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. See you all later.
On this anniversary year, a true bounty can be found in the merchandise store. T-shirts, mugs, and an incredible range of posters. All exclusive products. Every one the perfect way to remember this unique time. At the end of the festival, a very special poster will be available. But no need to wait for that. See what you can pick up today.